Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Friday, December 20th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. This morning, we'll look at a couple of studies, one launching soon to take a snapshot of Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander health, and a study out this week ranking professional ethics and honesty.
Then an open door for the tech challenge to learn a few tricks and hike their computer confidence. Later, we'll talk to a group of Kauai authors gathering to read the holiday classics.
That and the backyard quiz and today's reality check and a whole bunch more coming up right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. A little vintage Backstreet Boys there.
Is that what that was?
That's what that was. You looked at me with this terribly blank look. It's okay, Chris. It's all right.
Just getting old, I guess.
Oh, no.
Some interesting news in the Native Hawaiian health front, yeah?
Yeah, really interesting news. A piece of, a study that we're going to talk about right now, because you may have noticed this in many national health surveys, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders are usually absent, or maybe they're lumped in with other ethnic groups listed as other. According to the census, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders make up just 0.4%, just 0.4% of the total U.S. population. And that makes it tough to include them in the surveys. But that's all about to change with the launch of the Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander National Health Interview Survey. It's a project of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Nadine Gracia is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health and the Director of the Office of Minority Health at the USHHS, and she's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, maybe it would be even better if you could be here with us instead of in Washington, where you are a lot colder than we are.
Indeed. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, whenever you're here, it's a standing one. But for the moment, let's talk about this study, because, for anyone who has gone looking for this information, they know why you call it unprecedented. There just isn't a lot of information out there, health information about Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders, that's quantified in the way that you anticipate doing. How did this come about?
Well, as you pointed out, Beth Ann, the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population comprises only 0.4% of the total U.S. population, and so it does make it difficult for us to be able to report in sufficient numbers the health status of this population in most of our national population health surveys. There's little data that exists so that we have health status information on this population at the national level. But what we do know from some of the limited data and research is that the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population really have health disparities, significant health disparities, such as higher rates of heart disease and high blood pressure. And so the importance of this project that has been announced by the National Center for Health Statistics at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and our office, the Office of Minority Health, is a project really aimed at improving health data collection for the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population.
As you mentioned, the disparities in health for Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians is nothing that's unknown to people in our parts of the world, just that we've been waiting for everybody else to sort of catch up and get hold of some of that information, difficult as it may be to come by. So specifically, how are you going to run this study?
So specifically, this study, or the survey itself, will be conducted by professional interviewers who work for the U.S. Census Bureau. And what these interviewers are being trained on how to actually conduct this specific study, the National Health Interview Survey for Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. And what the interviewers will do is, the interview process is that households, approximately 4,000 Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander households, will be sent a letter in advance of an interviewer actually contacting the household, and explains the survey, explains how the information will be used. And then an interviewer actually goes to the home of that household that has been identified as having at least one person who is Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, and conducts an interview with that household.
How about some cultural sensitivity training? Because you're talking about ways of being and lack of trust, perhaps, all kinds of things that may inhibit someone's ability to participate.
Absolutely. Cultural sensitivity, cultural competency is very important when we talk about health and certainly the health of racial and ethnic minority communities. The interviewers, all of the new and experienced interviewers, will actually be trained in cultural sensitivity and awareness before the survey begins next year.
Will they be people who are already based here in Hawaii?
So the current surveyors, we actually have hired additional surveyors in Hawaii. They're surveyors that interviewers that already exist there. And that training is happening, understanding that this is going to be a national survey. So there are interviewers all across the country, including in Hawaii.
When you finally get all of this information together, which is going to take you a while, it's only going to launch the beginning of next year, and then we won't have findings until, what, 2015?
2015, that's correct.
Right, so there's going to be a lot of assessment of information, but what do you intend to do with this, or how do you intend to use it as it reaches sort of the national radar?
So understanding that this type of information, where we're learning more about the health status of Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander populations, the data can be used by policymakers, by researchers. It can be used by public health departments and other health professionals, by healthcare and service providers, but also importantly by the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander community members, leaders, and organizations alike. And what these data really can help is to be used to plan policies that will help to improve Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander health and well-being, to help develop programs to improve Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander health, or to improve some of the public health and healthcare services that are provided for this population.
I'd move those policies more toward a national perspective, not just something that we deal with here locally.
Right. You know, this survey, it actually supports HHS's action plan to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities. 2 years ago, our department released the first ever department-wide strategic action plan focusing on addressing and reducing health disparities. And this research and data collection, so that we can better identify health disparities and develop targeted interventions programs that will help to reduce disparities, is one of the key goals of the disparities action plan.
And isn't this tied into the ACA?
So also with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, the health care law that was signed by President Obama more than 3 years ago, part of the Affordable Care Act in Section 4302 of the Affordable Care Act calls for this type of data collection where we are really working to improve our understanding of disparities along race, ethnicity, primary language, disability status, and sex. So this survey also supports the implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
I want to thank you so much for being willing to join us this morning. And as you said, if only you were here in person.
Well, thank you again for the invitation. And thank you for sharing this news and letting the community know about the importance of the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander National Health Interview Survey that will begin in February of next year.
We'll be checking back with you in the interim as it is developing and finding out how things are going, and certainly looking forward to seeing what findings result and getting those, but that's not going to be for a while yet. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Take care.
Happy holidays.
You as well.
Dr. Nadine Gracia is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health and the Director of the Office of Minority Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She oversees the implementation of the HHS Action Plan to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities and the National Partnership for Action to End Health Disparities. More about the Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander National Health Interview Survey is on HPR2.org. This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. So, someone in your family is still scared of technology? Well, a local group has some help to dispel the fear. But first, the backyard quiz. Everybody chant.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolawe, uhawai.
In today's quiz, some uninvited visitors to the islands over a century ago. In 1907, Mediterranean fruit flies, or medflies, reached Hawaii from Australia. They quickly began ravaging crops and found a home near the leeward dry areas of the islands in areas of both high and low elevations. If you've ever been to the airport, you've probably noticed the signs warning against the transportation of certain fruits and agricultural items to the mainland. This formal quarantine on fruit is directly related to those nasty medflies. Their presence in Hawaii represents a major threat to mainland agriculture. Should these flies populate the mainland, the effect would impact food production and prices. And for today's quiz, we want to know if you can tell us how long a typical Mediterranean fruit fly lives. If entomology isn't your strong suit, stick around. We'll tell you the lifespan of these little pests later in the show.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Jake Shimabukuro. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio.
There's still a technology divide in our society, and the people on the outside, the ones who don't know a bit from a bite, tend to feel they're stuck out there. The divide is just too wide to get across. Not so, according to Marco Morowek, who says he can teach even the tech challenge to code in a single drink from the fire hose weekend. He'll be doing just that at UH in a couple of weeks, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Marco.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
The image of drink from a fire hose stays with me, as I'm sure it's meant to, because you're talking about a pretty radical different approach, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to condense about 4 to 5 weeks of self-taught material into a single weekend. Now, we feel like that's how it is in the real world. You got to go move fast, learn as much as you can quickly.
An awful lot of people, including me, are going to say, I just don't have it to absorb that much. You know, traditionally, we present information in digestible bites, right?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're teaching learning by doing. So it's really like we say this is a fire hose weekend, and you're going to get a lot of knowledge in a really short amount of time, like really condensed. And we always do it first, and then we stop, and we explain what we've really done. And since a lot of steps are happening in the same way, you pick it up really quickly. And it's really surprising to me, and I'm really astonished how quickly people can pick up really complex concepts.
Do you think, Marco, part of that is the reinforcement of doing something and getting a result, whether you understand what just happened or not?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, we're writing a few lines of code, and then we immediately looking in our browser, in our Internet Explorer, Chrome, or Firefox, like what that code that we just written, what it produced, and then people see the results immediately. And that's what I mean when I say, you know, learning by doing. You write some and you see the result.
Just to back up a little bit, learning to code in the sense of I've got a new business widget incorporated and I want to open up my website and get my product out to market. That's the kind of person you're reaching, right?
There's three and a half, four kind of different people that come to our workshops. So a lot of people, you know, right now in Hawaii is really awesome that too. In the startup scene, you know, they say like, I need a technical co-founder. I don't know how to build something. I've never done anything. I've never built a website, never built a web application or mobile app. So those are the guys to come to us because they couldn't find a technical co-founder and they want to learn it yourself. And actually doing it yourself is one of the best ways of attracting a technical co-founder. Then we have people who say like, you know, I want to be a better citizen. If I don't know how to code in 5-10 years, I might be at a significant disadvantage. So this is a step for me in testing out how I like this in a single weekend. Then we also have people who say, I need to communicate with technical people, like the programmers at work. You know, that's what really helps me if I understand and look under the hood how everything, how all the pieces fit together.
So you're talking about coding as something that, that we're going to need to understand the way we learn how to read.
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you look back like 500 years ago, right, when the printing press came out, and then it was like, if you could read and write, you were at a significant advantage. And I think the same like digital divide is going to happen right now in the society already. If you can code, you can produce things. If you cannot code, you can only use things that other people created for you.
And you're, by that sense, dependent.
Yeah, pretty much, if you want to put it that way.
Or limited somehow, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to maybe create it from scratch, but if you understand it and you have a good grasp on it, you can use some of the pieces. I mean, that's what open source is. There's so much code out there, it's freely available for everyone to use. And you can use that and build on top of it, or just change it slightly so it fits your needs.
I'm sure that you have a lot of people at the beginning of these firehose weekends who are skeptical, right?
Yeah.
This is never going to work. I mean, I'm going to do this, but it's never going to work. And what do they tell you at the end?
I mean, what happens, like, you know, Saturday morning, 7 minutes in, people tell me, like, they ask me the really simple question, like, what is HTML? What's the H1 tag? And we explain that quickly. And then the same people on, like, Sunday around noon, so we're talking, like, a little more than 24 hours later, they will use things like migration, databases, all kinds of tech things, controllers, views, and looking at error message that they didn't know what those words meant and didn't know how to execute that. And those are the same people. So it's really astonishing for me how quickly people can absorb that. And we see that throughout our weekends. Everyone, so far, 100% of our students build a fully functional web application and had it live on the internet by Sunday afternoon.
The thing about drinking from the fire hose, the way you describe it, is I'm sure nobody gets bored, right?
You shouldn't get bored. I mean, you basically...
There's no excuse for that.
There's no excuse. It goes really fast. And as I mentioned earlier, we're doing kind of these two-hour sprints. We go in really hard live coding, meaning I'm coding with all the students together on a big projector. And then we have, like, after two-hour sprint, we have a break, and then we, like, stop and say, this is what we've just done. And then we go for another two-hour sprint. So, yeah, I mean, you're waiting for that lunch break and be like, okay, I just want to have a quick break to digest this. But it's a fire hose weekend, so you're going to get hosed.
But you do find that there's a rhythm to the way the human mind absorbs, right?
Definitely.
Couple hours intensive, sit back, think about it, chill for a minute,
yep.
Do another couple hours.
That's pretty much what we're seeing. Like, people, you know, I can tell by the look of the students in the class that they're like right now at this point where they're like, okay, this is going to get really hard. And then we make a break and we say, okay, let's recap quickly. Let's give you a moment to fill in all the holes in your notes and maybe double check on your code and everything and double check what it really produced.
I'm getting this image in my mind of a hard drive filling up, you know, one of those little bars with the blue. I mean, that's kind of what happens to people's minds.
Yeah. Exactly. Or a hard drive is a good example, or a glass that is empty and you slowly fill it with water.
Yeah. So you sort of take a pause, drink a couple hours, and do it again.
Exactly.
How long have you been doing this, Marco?
So we've been doing this for the last, I think, 3-4 months. We've done workshops, a few in Boston, one in New York City, one with Harvard Business School. That was really fun. One in Pittsburgh. We have scheduled more in. Now we have one in Hawaii on January 4 and 5th. And we're going to go to Philadelphia as well, and probably the Rhode Island School of Design as well in February.
Well, it really is an interesting take on just how people learn in general, Marco. So it's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Marco Morawek will lead a Firehose Learn to Code weekend at UH Manoa January 3rd through 5th. It's a University of Hawaii Pacific New Media workshop. You can learn more at hpr2.org.
Have you spotted any snowy owls, eyed any egrets? I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on Science Friday for one of our favorite holiday traditions, the annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count. Plus, why is Google buying robots that run? All on Science Friday from NPR.
This morning at 9, following the conversation.
After all the brouhaha over the federal budget, Congress passed one this week without a lot of fanfare. Maybe that's because of the cuts to military benefits and Medicare and more plane fees. Not good news for Hawaii. And Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the details in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, all that finger pointing and the vitriol spewing that we saw for such a long time that basically became reality TV from Washington kind of led to this very quiet and somewhat of an anticlimax this week with the passage of the budget. But those consequences really aren't so pretty, especially for Alaska and Hawaii. You've been talking to some of our delegation. What did they have to say about this?
Adrienne LaFrance spoke to Colleen Hanabusa, and she was in our office as well yesterday. We've talked to Brian Schatz, got comment from the other delegates as well. Now, we won't know the final details until the appropriations committees get together in January. But basically, Colleen Hanabusa said the cuts, she called them harmful and unnecessary. In fact, she actually voted against the budget deal. Schatz, Gabbard, and Hirono voted for it. She felt that strongly against it. One big reason, there's a $6 billion reduction in the cost of living benefits for military veterans that are under 62 years of age. Hanabusa said that's us breaking our word to the military. That's just one example of something in this defense budget, or rather the final budget, that is so upsetting to at least Hanabusa and some of the other delegates as well.
I'm curious, because that would seem like something that would really bother Tulsi Gabbard.
Yes, it does. And one of the things that really upsets her a great deal is there's a $13 billion hike in airline fees. And that's going to affect us tremendously here because we depend so much on the inter-island air. Same with Alaska. I can tell you that all four delegates are trying to get some sort of exemption for Hawaii and Alaska. It's going to double the fees that we pay on round trip to the inter-island back and forth. So that's another cost, Barry, that really hits us. We depend so heavily on transportation, air transportation.
And we should say that will come to, what, about $10 or so and go into effect as of next October.
That's right. Imagine those folks that take flights every week because of business or other reasons, and that can really add up.
Well, at this point, as you say, we need to have some more details emerge, or more quite specific details. But so far, you know, the good news is, yes, we have a budget, and yes, we're moving forward. But some of those issues, particularly with what's happening with the military spending cuts and also Medicare. Let's talk about Medicare a little bit more.
Well, what it's going to do is the deal extends by 2 years the sequester level cuts that were already in place. So that's not going to help our elderly, our kapuna. That's going to limit their access to care. That's another thing that has our folks in Washington really concerned. I can tell you that Brian Schatz did say, look, overall, budget was the best we could do. It was a bipartisan deal. At least we're not shutting down the government. At least we're not coming up with stopgap measures just to keep the government going a little bit more at a time. But clearly there's a lot more work to be done. This was just really a temporary fix. Mind you, a two-year one, but already come January, come March, we're going to have to deal with another extension to the debt ceiling. So it ain't over yet.
Far from it, and especially for people who depend upon providers who will accept Medicare, as we're talking about that at this moment. Already, the fact that, you know, funds have been cut, they say that Medicare payments are so low, and it's the reason that a number of doctors say that there's only a certain amount of patients that they're willing to serve or can serve.
Exactly. And here in Hawaii, we have a very large elderly population, fortunately because of the good health rates that we have here, the good health longevity rates. But it is going to affect our kapuna tremendously. I can tell you that our delegates tell us they're going to try and find a way to help reduce those sequester level cuts on Medicare come the new year.
All right. Well, we'll be watching for those and have more to talk about it as we get into next year. Meanwhile, have yourself a merry little Christmas, big, small, and joyful. I'll talk to you when I'm back in January.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Safe travels.
Thanks so much. Aloha. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. Oh, into a Friday morning, but that often means that we're looking toward the next week, at least in terms of what's happening with our news department. And it's the time of year, Bill Dorman, when we often look backward anyway, and in casting that backward glance, this time around, you're going to do that from a business perspective.
Yeah, holiday season, you know, that sort of look back, look ahead, think about things approaching the year end. It's a chance to do some of that. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to take a look at some of the publicly held companies based here in Hawaii and how they've been doing over the past year. You know, if you are of a bent to look at markets and things, you know already that this has been a surprisingly strong year for the stock market generally. S&P 500 is up something like 28%, I think, year to date. And for some locally held companies or locally based companies, they've been along for the ride. Some have not been. And it's an interesting sort of split to look at what's been going on and also some of the activities. I mean, you have, you know, just as one example, A&B has sunk nearly $750 million into local properties just in the back half of this year alone. You know, Matson, this was their first year spun off from A&B in terms of a separate company for the first full year. They've sort of gone the other way. They've not had a good year stock market-wise, molasses spill-wise. Local financial companies have generally had a good year. But it's an interesting mix, so we'll take a closer look. And it being the holiday season, one thing that we're starting out actually a new segment, Dave Lawrence, is called Helping Hand, which is basically taking a look and talking with some people who work to help others in the community. This is a wide range of groups, starting with the Aloha chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, talking about what they do and how volunteers can get involved and what contributors can also expect in terms of return on charitable investment.
The good that goes on no matter what the season and is so dependent upon those volunteers. And
exactly.
So much of the public-private partnerships that we see happening with nonprofit organizations certainly playing a huge role.
Exactly. And we look at that, of course, with the new session. We'll be looking at everything from community block grants to other sort of government funding sides of that. But again, that private, that individual, people who jump in and take part and help in the community, that's so critical to the success of the community. And so we'll focus a bit more on that.
Well, thanks so much. We'll look forward to that for next week.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director. For over 35 years, Gallup polls have asked Americans to rank their perceptions of the ethical standards and honesty of various professions. Now, the poll came out this week, and lawyers were right down there with journalists. Not good news for the news-gathering profession, but then the long backward glance would suggest that's not unexpected. We asked Media Watcher and Hawaii Pacific University Communications Professor John Hart for his assessment, and he joins us now. Good morning, John.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Malay Kalikimaka.
That too, or as we often say, Merry Christmas. Looking at this poll, there are some things which are kind of shocking and some things that are not. One being that lobbyists are at the very bottom of the list at a 6% rating of ethics and honesty. Nurses top the list at 82%. Pretty amazing thing, even higher than the honesty that people feel they're getting from their own doctors. But hovering in the same place around the 20s is where journalists are, and lawyers came in at 20. Is there something we should be extracting from this?
Well, I think it's a reflection of what I would say is the commercialization and cableization, and you would probably add consolidation of news.
You're right, I would.
Yeah, I think that once back in the day when we had three networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, they had to appeal to a broad audience. And so news was relatively objective. You couldn't offend anyone. Now we have cable, and everyone has their own news designed especially for them. If you're conservative, you watch Fox. If you're not, you watch something else. So news no longer informs, it reinforces. And so I think what you're seeing here is a vote not against what I watch, it's a vote against everything I don't watch.
I mean, long gone are the days where we really didn't know the true perspectives or leanings of news people, where that was something that just didn't come across. It wasn't transparent. It wasn't part of the delivery of news or the spin of it. I mean, Walter Cronkite, and I know you and I have talked about this before, people were shocked to find out that he was a liberal.
Yes. And it wasn't until that recent biography that took many people by surprise. And I'm sure you and I remember the day when Howard K. Smith gave his own opinion on something. It said commentary at the bottom. You no longer see that.
So there's such a mishmash of things, and it's so easy to find everything that you agree with. I mean, literally with a click of a button, you can go online within 10 seconds, find things that support exactly how you feel and don't necessarily challenge any of your beliefs. But as you look at how people regard journalists, and not just in this poll, but in others too, that honesty and ethical factor seems to have been hovering in the 20s now for quite a long time. So it's as if this is not just a new problem because we've been cableized for, you know, a decade or two, heavily so, but that this was always somewhat of an issue. And even at the top of the game, there were only about a third of the American public that said, yeah, we think journalists are ethical, are people who have integrity that we trust.
Well, like all golden ages, there never was one. I mean, we went through yellow journalism. We went through various stages. But we do remember a stage in the 1960s where, speaking back to Walter Cronkite, he was, after all, in the polls, what? The most trusted man in America. And he wasn't a nurse.
And we don't seem to have anyone who has that kind of cachet.
No one with that kind of ethos. I think part of the problem was that first C we talked about, commercialization. There was a time when news was public service and it was hands off in terms of programming. When general managers realized the best local ad money they were making were from news shows, they started paying attention to the content. And that's when I think we hit a shift that we've never really recovered from in broadcast news.
Is there any way that you see that this can be increased? I mean, we won't say regained. Maybe we'll never get to that not-so-golden age of a third of the American public saying, yes, we think that broadcast people are trustworthy. But something that goes beyond 20 or 24?
Well, yeah, it's very difficult because now with the Internet, which is a new medium, just not an additional medium, it puts so much information at your fingertips. It's no longer a matter of information gathering. It's a matter of information filtering. And how we do that, I think, is going to be the big answer in how we proceed with understanding our world.
In looking at some of the other issues that we talk about with journalism and trustworthiness, and the fact that you've just made the point that you've now have to go and really ask yourself how trustworthy someone is, just because it appears there. We've said that for decades. Just because something is online doesn't mean you have to trust it. But what kind of proof, when you talk to your students and you talk to them about this and you watch media, what questions do you ask them to ask themselves to sort of prove whether or not someone is reasonably trustworthy of their time and attention?
Yeah. Well, you know, at Hawaii Pacific University, we still teach a ethics class in journalism, as they do in every major journalism program or journalism major. The problem is the students want to do well. They want to be ethical. But when they go out in that world and they face a general manager who really doesn't care about that, who says, our ratings, that's when you get into this Benghazi situation where you violate one of the basic tenets of journalism, which is what? Two sources. You need to have somebody back it up. And when you're willing to go for the scoop without that second source, this is what happens.
Or third, or in some cases, fifth.
Exactly. Whatever you need to say, I feel comfortable running this story.
So how do you prepare students to cope with that?
It's difficult, you know. I mean, you can, like a parent, you teach them, and at some point you hope they can go out in the world and do it, but it's a world where that's fraught with a lot of decisions, and it's no different for a journalist than it is for everyone else in a job who has to make an ethical call.
So back to the Gallup poll, they can expect that they're going to be in that, 20 or 22% of folks who actually believe that they're trustworthy.
Well, I think they need to remember it's not their job to be liked.
And that's the bottom line. However, when it comes to car salespeople beating out members of Congress, well, we'll talk about likability factors and people who get elected another time. Thanks so much, John,
Mahalo,
for coming in. And John Hart is a professor at Hawaii Pacific University, and he joined us this morning to assess the latest Gallup poll, which you can see on hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Pops Orchestra Series, presenting It's the Holiday Season, Dinner, Dance, and Concert, featuring Amy Hanaialii with guests Jim Nabors and Emma Veery, December 21st at the Hawaii Convention Center, hawaiipops.com.
Now back to today's backyard quiz. Many of you may be traveling to the mainland over the next few days, and your bags will get an agricultural screening. This morning we focused on one of the reasons why, one of Hawaii's invasive species, the Mediterranean fruit fly. It arrived in 1907 and quickly spread throughout every island in our state, devastating fruit production and agricultural development. These little bugs prefer dry and leeward sides of the islands, and they're comfortable at both high and low elevations. And if they were to be transmitted to the mainland, the pests could renew devastation periodically done there. For our question today, we asked if you could tell us how long a typical medfly lives. And, well, okay, the question was a bit of a trick. The answer is, it depends. That's because a typical medfly lives around 21 days in tropical climates, and in colder weather, the medfly lifespans can increase to upward of 100 days, making it even more deadly on the mainland. It's now 8:47, and that's our quiz. If you have one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, proud to support ACLU Hawaii, unitariansofhi.org.
If you're wondering what kind of gift to give a child this holiday, here's a thought. You can't go wrong with a book. If you doubt the appeal of reading to children, all you have to do is look at their faces when someone is reading aloud to them. And if you're on Kauai, your next opportunity will come Christmas Eve, when local children's books authors will be reading to kids from their own works. Lauren Pingree is coordinating the free event, and we caught up with her by phone.
It's the holiday. holiday season, and we have an office at the Shops at Kukui'ula, and all the merchants there are kind of doing promotions and things to give back to the community. So we just really wanted to get involved, and we've always been really interested in giving back to the children and supporting children's literacy, mm-hmm. and just kind of, you know, the children's sports programs. So we've Roberta Charles, our broker in charge, she came up with the idea. And so it was just going from there and implementing it and kind of doing the discovery period and looking in and seeing who the local children's authors were. And I was lucky. I stumbled upon the Kauai Children's Authors Guild. And from there, it just kind of evolved.
There are enough children's book authors on Kauai to actually have their own little community, huh?
Yes. There are, you'd be really surprised. There are maybe like at least 5 or 6 active members in the guild.
Well, you know, I don't know if I would be surprised, because I keep finding these amazing things that people in Kauai are doing, and that's clearly one of them. What kind of subjects do they take on, these authors?
You know, the books, they really kind of stem from everything from, you know, a coloring book that Monica Mira has written, and then there's also, you know, Carol Peacock, and she wrote this great book called Benny the Beetle, to Mark Huff, who his books are The King of the Beach and The Sheltering Place. I mean, they kind of cover just, you know, kids spending time on the beach, just enjoying beautiful outdoors of Kauai, and just celebrating living here in Hawaii.
You kind of have your own built-in subject matter for things of this nature, don't you?
Yeah, it's pretty easy to draw influence from what's going on outside here.
What kind of reaction do you get from the kids in these reading programs?
They love it. I mean, they're really excited. You know, we were kind of worried because, you know, we were going to have kids of all ages. And, I mean, children from as young as like 2 years old to 10, 11, 12 have been coming. And they'll just sit there patiently and they, you know, interact with the author. I mean, they seem to really love it.
When you see a kid kind of get the reading bug, it's always kind of inspiring to see, isn't it? Do you get to see that through these programs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the children, they really love to be read to, you know, and that's just the fundamental of growing up to love literature. You just really got to read to the kids, and they enjoy it.
Are most of these books illustrated?
Yes, they're all illustrated.
So you have that sort of connection and at that early time in the child's life, that connection to from words to making visual images. And that, in a way, it always seems to me that children's books are kind of transitional, right? They give you the words and the images, but there's still room for your imagination to take flight. Is that how it seems to you?
No, absolutely. You know, because yes, there are images, but they're still images. And so it's really up to the brain to kind of craft the action taking place behind the words or with the words. So it's a great time in a kid's life because they've got just such large imaginations that they can kind of fill in the blanks.
So you see that happening in these sessions, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
Who are some of the other Kauai children's books authors?
So we're featuring 3 this month. There's Carol Peacock, there's Mark Huff and Monica Mira. Mm-hmm. There's a few others. Mark Jeffers, who's in charge of the Storybook Theater, he's another Kauai children's author. There is Susan Durker, and she's based out of the North Shore. And then let's see who's else. There's another one, but I'm forgetting her name. But there's quite a few, and those are just the members that are in the guild. I mean, there's at least a few more.
Did you ever talk to sort of aspiring children's books authors who want to, you know, maybe have the impulse to do it but aren't quite sure how to proceed? Are there things they could learn from the people who already have gone down this path?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because when we started doing this series, other people came up to me and they're like, oh, well, I've written a children's book. I'm like, are you published? Oh, no, I'm waiting to do it till when I retire. So, I mean, really, it's encouraging. There's a lot of people writing these books out here, and it's so easy to get published these days. You can even self-publish. So I really just would encourage everyone to do it.
So there's almost this little hidden community of children's book authors.
Yeah, an underground literary committee. I like it.
Yeah, I do too. I like the idea of sort of having a project that you're saving for your retirement years to really polish it together. Is that what these people are telling you?
Yeah, you know, even one of our, he's our highest producing realtor here at Coble Banker Mackay Properties, Drew Vento. He tells me he has all these Hawaiiana like themed children's books that he's kind of has the rough sketch out, and he's just waiting to retire. I mean, I never would have known it. So, well, yes, I think he's looking forward to doing that when he retires, but we hope he doesn't retire anytime soon.
From observing these sessions, do you get a sort of a sense of what really works best in reach, you know, what really fires kids' imagination? Are there some common threads that you see?
You know, I really think, I mean, the children love to be read to, you know, and I really think what it takes is getting the parents to work with on that with them, you know, because the parents have to take the kids to these events that we're putting on, mm-hmm. you know, and then further just instill the love of reading at home. I mean, parents really should be reading to their kids like nightly, because it just helps the kids get a passion for reading, and that just helps them throughout their entire lives and in their academic lives when they're younger, which sets them up for the rest of their life.
Well, it seems like one of the fundamentals of using your mind, in the sense of taking words on a page, making your own pictures, and maybe leading from that to coming up with ideas of your own, yeah?
Well, absolutely.
So fun to watch that in the process, I would imagine. A lot of fun.
No, it's been really a rewarding project, and we're really enjoying it. And, you know, we're thinking about maybe continuing it on. And I know that the Children's Kauai Authors Guild is doing their Read Across Kauai Day on February 28th, mm-hmm. and they're hoping to do that in the local schools around here. So we're thinking maybe of participating, but we're not quite sure yet.
So reading to kids doesn't have to just be a seasonal thing, does it?
No, absolutely not. It should be a nightly thing, a daily thing.
Well, thanks very much for, I appreciate what you guys are doing over there to encourage this, Lauren, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Lauren Pingree works at Coldwell Banker Mackay Properties on Kauai. They're sponsoring readings by Kauai children's book authors. The next one will be Christmas Eve at 3:30 outside their office at the shops at Kuku'ila, and you can hear more from our HPR2 website, .org website.
Brazilian guitar virtuoso Carlos Barbosa Lima returns to the Atherton Studio Saturday, December 28th at 7:30 p.m. for a solo recital. Selections will range from Latin American to American standards and pop. Tickets at 955-8821 during business hours or online at hprtickets.org.
While I was talking to John Hart about that latest Gallup poll ranking ethical standards and honesty of various professions as Americans see them, you were shaking your head.
Well, I mean, I try not to take an old fogey's perspective about media and journalism, but I did spend some time in television news. My father was a radio news commentator of the 40s and 50s, and it obviously has changed over the years. It's always tempting to say, well, things have gone to hell in a handbasket since I was there, but it's not that simple. They're very changing technology, changing audience, changing everything. So it's kind of tricky to sort out how journalism adapts to the new methods of communication. That's really what's going on today.
I mean, you have both consolidation on one hand and fragmentation on the other, and sometimes fragmentation within the consolidation. It's a very confusing situation for a lot of people, and when it's so easy to find things that you only agree with as opposed to pushing out a little bit, it adds to the mix and doesn't necessarily make it any easier to determine trustworthiness. Anyway, that's going to do it for us for this week. Now, I want to tell you, coming up next week, Marlene Booth will be here because I will be away spending some time with my family for a couple of weeks. And also coming up at 9 o'clock, Science Friday is going to be preempted so that we can bring you President Obama's speech.
Next week, we'll also have holiday music on a classical guitar from our friend Ian O'Sullivan.
That's going to be good. Let us in on your radio talkback. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Fire off 140 characters to us at HI Conversation. I'm at Because HPR. And good old email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, find out about the music from our shows, you can check the HPR website, hpr2.org.
Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
The Land Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join Chris and Marlene on Monday and pick up the conversation. Merry Christmas, everybody. I'll see you in January.